It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While schools are out all over Iowa, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, we're learning about Iowa wildlife, and on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. This time of year, if you are lucky enough to be near a wetland, a pond, a lake, maybe a big puddle, you can hear the spring chorus of Iowa's frogs and toads. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University and our resident biology teacher here on Talk of Iowa. And he's with us today to introduce us to our amphibian neighbors. Hello, Jim.
Jorgerum. Jorgerum. Oh, sorry, Charity. I was just practicing.
Just singing along.
My frog call.
Well, I don't have a recording of the cacophony that you can hear this time of year, not when it's cold like today, but this time of year if you go out on a warm morning or warm evening. But give us an idea. I mean, it can almost be deafening, can't it?
Well, in the heat of the summer, it certainly is deafening. When you have a bunch of species all calling together, the waters have warmed up enough that they've come out of hibernation, because these little guys, some of them as the size of your thumbnail, overwinter for the most part in the mud beneath at the bottom of a pond. Ectotherms, there's a great word for people to look up. Ectotherms meaning they take their temperature from their surrounding. Some people would call it cold-blooded, but that has some other meanings too. So we call them ectotherms. And so they live in the mud at the bottom of the pond through the winter. And you say, well, criminy sakes, how do they do that? They do it because their body slows down so much that they can absorb all the oxygen they need through the winter out of the water. They actually can breathe through their skin, and they are able to absorb enough, just enough oxygen to make it through the winter, and they live off their fat reserves as well. But when they come out in the spring, they start to sing. Now, I will have to tell you, I'm sorry, it's just the males that sing. because they have the strongest voices, and they sing for lots and lots of reasons.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those reasons. If only the males are singing, I'm guessing that this has something to do with courtship.
Yeah, it does. How did you guess?
It's a recurring theme on our shows recently.
It is. So, yeah, they're basically advertising. And they're advertising lots of things about themselves. Number one, they're advertising that they are a certain species, because different species have different songs. They're advertising, of course, secondly, to the females, saying, hey, here I am. But it's more than that. It's more than just advertising. It's saying, I am strong and vigorous. So the strength of their call, the rapidness of their call, how long they can hold the note, all of those things go into determining whether they are vigorous enough and fit enough to attract females into their area. They also, of course, sing to establish a territory, saying, here I am. All the rest of you males, stay out. But in a pond, in a small vernal pool that might be 10 feet across, and if you've got dozens and dozens of males singing, that territory isn't all that big. It also helps spread out their what we call partition the resources, because frogs have to eat through the spring and summer months, so that it says, I'm protecting this territory. I'm going to chase the other males out as much as I can, and I have the resources to help you raise a family. It also stimulates other males to sing, and it stimulates the females, of course, to breed. So there are lots of reasons they sing. It's not all the reasons we sing, but we sing because we're happy or because it's our living or something. But frogs have other things in mind.
So the frogs, I have to give the females a little bit of credit here because they must be very discerning listeners. When you hear this cacophony of sound, it's amazing to think about picking out the sound of just one frog and zeroing in on him and thinking, yes, you do have the nicest song. You do sound like you have the best genes that I would like my offspring to carry.
Well, she is discerning to some degree. And it's just, like I say, it's the strength of the song, the rapidity of it. But the rapidity is mainly determined by the temperature. That's why you mentioned early, the last couple of nights, they've been silent nights because the temperatures over most of the state have been at or below freezing. At those temperatures, frogs are not singing. It is very tough for them. Unless the water is warmer, we had a little skim on our pond this morning, a skim of ice. So we didn't hear any frogs last night at all. They were quiet. But now I have to tell you that she's not that discerning, because as she swims in to mate with one frog, she's still listening for other frogs. So she may mate with several other males all at the same time in that area. But she can be somewhat discerning, but maybe it's not as picky as you'd like.
All right. Now, what are the male frogs doing to make this song? It's so loud. It's so much louder than an animal that size should be able to be. What do they do?
Okay, well, as adults, frogs have lungs. They do have to absorb up to 25% of the oxygen, even during the summer months, through their skin. But they do have lungs, and so what the first thing they're doing is they're pumping air from their lungs, sort of into their larynx, into this big sac around or below their lower jaw. And it pushes the air back and forth across the larynx, the sound maker in them. And as that air goes back and forth, the pumping of the throat, the largeness of the throat, serves almost like an echo chamber. That's why it sounds so loud. So you've got a little spring chorus frog that's the size of your thumbnail, or a spring peeper, even smaller sometimes. And it's like you say, you get a bunch of them together, and it just sounds almost deafening. So these guys are pretty adept at making that echo chamber available to pass that sound back and forth over their voice box. It's almost a staccato kind of thing as it passes across that larynx. So the comparison has been made to, for a frog, it's almost like running a marathon. That's why it's such an incredible indicator of health and fitness and strength, because they're able to, this little tiny guy is able to get out all that sound.
And I mentioned toads. Toads are also doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, toads come a little later, usually. I mean, with all species, just like we've noticed and we've talked about in birds, there always seems to be these early migrants that come back earlier than anybody else, or later than anybody else. And so you've got this sort of range of migration taking place, so that species are sort of hedging their bets, if you will. If you arrive too early, you may or may not be able to nest. But if you arrive so early, maybe you're preparing for a change in the climate, and you'll actually get the best nest sites. The same is true with frogs. Some frogs emerge early, not only by species, but individuals within that species, and others emerge later. And toads in general tend to emerge a little later in the spring, early summer, so we won't hear them for a while, but there are some you can hear earlier than you think. You know, you say, gee, amongst those chorus frogs or the spring peepers, I think I'm hearing an American toad. out there going, and you may very well be hearing that because there's some that have kind of pushed the window and said, I'm going to try it today early because I feel good. So
the toads. Oh, go on.
I was going to say the toads are different than frogs, although they're very closely related in that they don't have to have a wet skin like the frogs do. They do have to have damp skin. They have to absorb some moisture and oxygen through their skin. So frogs tend to have drier skin than, or excuse me, toads tend to have drier skin than frogs do. But they still have to be dampish. And also, they don't necessarily overwinter in the mud below the ground, but they will often dig. If you go outside in the springtime or in the fall, you can see where toads and salamanders and other things have dug down, often right next to the foundation of your house where it's easy to dig. And you'll see these little tunnels going down, and it's often toads that will overwinter in loose soil, but they try to get down as deep as they can, of course, below frost line. This is another interesting thing about frogs. There are some species that, you know, it's almost like they, how do they do it in a shallow pond when the water is frozen above them and, or the soil is frozen above them and they can still breathe. They don't need much oxygen at all. But what happens with some frogs is that they can actually, with some species, they found some that can actually get the animal themselves is below freezing. The cells, within the cells, they have a little bit of a glycogen, which helps, serves as an antifreeze within the cell. But between the cells, they might be frozen. So oftentimes in the early spring, you'll see this pond that opens up, and it looks like dead frogs are floating up on top. The water isn't quite warm enough, and within a day, they may come alive again. It's really remarkable.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We're learning about the frogs and toads of Iowa. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa. Tuesdays, while school is out, school is in session here with our resident biology teacher, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And today we are talking about Iowa's frogs and toads. And we want to bring somebody else into the conversation now as well. Stephanie Shepherd is also a wildlife biologist. She works for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and runs the Frog and Toad Survey. Hello, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we have a lot of frog sounds that we're going to be listening to here in just a moment. But Stephanie, I want to ask you, because with this frog and toad survey, you're sending people out all over the state to go to wetlands to listen to this cacophony of sound. And you actually have trained people to pick out the different frog calls. How do you do a survey of a population by listening?
It is a really cool thing. I mean, it's not, first of all, it's not as intimidating as having to like go out and identify birds by ear, which, you know, there's a lot of, you know, bird lovers in the state that can distinguish between hundreds of different species of birds. Whereas with our frogs in Iowa, we're only talking about 16 species. So it's a little less intimidating to learn all those sounds. And even among those 16, you know, there's probably five of those that aren't really common that you're not going to run into a lot. So basically, I usually tell folks to focus on the most common species they're going to hear. And the other nice thing, y'all have already kind of mentioned this, is that the frogs kind of spread themselves out throughout the summer. So not everybody is calling at the same time. So you're also going to have like a different group of species that are calling, you know, during the different periods. So it kind of breaks it down into a more doable thing to think about identifying and learning what these calls are and who's making what sound.
And can you actually estimate the number of frogs or toads that you're hearing by listening?
A little bit. So we use an index and not an exact number. So people aren't generally trying to count the number of individuals that we're calling, because if you get a whole passel of chorus frogs going, there's no way you're going to be able to pick out individuals. So basically, we have three different levels. There's a one, which is basically you've got one or two individuals calling that you can hear. There's a two, which is you've got maybe, you know, 5 to 10, and they're overlapping, and you can kind of, but you can still pick out individual calls. And then there's three, which is the full chorus, which means there's a whole lot of frogs calling at the same time, a particular species.
Well, let's listen to some of these sounds, and then we can talk a little bit more about how we might want to go out and listen. And Jim, let's start with the chorus frog. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this frog?
Well, the chorus frog is this small little frog that Stephanie was just talking about, and I thought that your description of what a passel is, I think
yes.
That's a great,
yes.
Great description. That's a lot of frogs. They're everywhere. And
yes.
So a passel of an individual chorus frog sounds like if you took a very stiff plastic comb and you take your thumbnail, if you have thumbnails, and you run it across the teeth. That's kind of what a single chorus frog sounds like. But then you get a bunch of them together, and it's a much denser sound than that. So let's listen to one of these.
All right, and that is not me running my fingernail along a comb. That's a really precise description. But that is the chorus frog. And so when do they start to sing, Jim?
Well, they've already started, actually. Depending on where you are in the state, certainly in northwest Iowa, they've gone back to sleep. They're saying, with that snow yesterday and the day before, they're saying, sorry, I'm done for a while here. They're going to wait for it to warm up. Maybe later in the week they'll be back again. But they're one of the very earliest callers in the state of Iowa. They'll call depending on where you are and depending on the spring, of course. They'll call anywhere from mid to late March up through well into May. But again, it depends on the temperature of the water. Now, that single male you just heard, I talked about how they will stimulate one another. You notice he called for a little bit, and then there was another one answering him going, oh, okay, I'm going to sing as well. So they're fascinating little guys, but they will – I don't know if you have a recording of what a whole passel sounds like.
No, I just pulled out the individual there, although you can imagine, just magnify that. Let's talk about the spring peeper right now, too, because obviously in the name, we know that this is a frog that starts singing pretty early as well. Tell us about the spring peeper.
Well, these guys, these are really tiny little frogs. And either one of these, if you start searching for them, of course, if you have a flashlight out there, even a red cellophane-covered flashlight, which helps a little bit, but they see the movement, and they will stop singing immediately. So you have to be very patient. If you really want to see one, or even more, get a photo of one, you have to be where they're really intensely singing at that time of year. These little guys are so small, I say smaller than your thumbnail. They're called Hyla crucifer, and that means they have a cross on their back. And spring peepers, they sound a little bit like tiny bells jingling, but together it can be almost deafening when you have hundreds of these little spring peepers all singing together. Let's see if we can hear some.
All right, those are some spring peepers. And I know I have already heard chorus frogs and spring peepers this time of year. I never see the frogs because I'm rarely at a pond or a puddle, even without a dog with me. And so the dogs make sure all the frogs have jumped into the water.
right.
You can't possibly see them.
One thing to know about beekeepers also is they're only in the eastern part of the state.
Right. That's what I was just going to ask, is that where are they finding those in Iowa now? Is there any spread to the west, or are we strictly sort of central Iowa eastward?
Yeah, they are definitely slowly creeping west. You can find them in like Guthrie County. I think we've had records, and we have them here in Boone County. So, you know, fairly far west. But if you're out in the far west, you won't hear spring peepers this time of year.
And Stephanie, how long have you been doing the frog and toad survey?
It'll be this is my 15th year, I think.
And over that time, are you seeing much change from year to year?
Definitely the spring peepers have, that's been a change since when I initially started. We've definitely picked up new locations for that species further west. And there's also been, you know, we've had weird weather years. I'm sure people are aware that we've had some interesting weather, and you can see some shifts in what the frogs and toads are doing. All the flooding we've had in the state, you can see them sort of expand out into sites where they haven't been heard before, and then they pull back. So yeah, it's always kind of changing from year to year.
And you have volunteers, citizen scientists, that you've trained to go out and listen to this. Unfortunately, this year, you're not going to get to train a new crop of citizen scientists because of the pandemic. But how many people, on average, do you have helping you with this survey?
This year, I think we have about 80 to 90 folks that are helping with that. And they do about, you know, 75 to 80 routes across the state, and each of those routes has 5 to 10 sites. So you can imagine that adds up to, I think each year, you know, on average, we survey between 500 to 600 wetlands across the state. So it's pretty significant.
Wow, that is significant. And you told us a little bit earlier about the index that these volunteers have to say, am I hearing a few of this species? Am I hearing a lot? Am I hearing a huge number of this species? They also pick out the different species, and you teach them how to identify these different calls, just like we're doing this hour. How do people become proficient? Is there a practice system that you assign people so that they get good at recognizing these calls?
We do have a CD of Iowa frog calls that is a special privilege of the volunteers. They get one of those to be able to practice. But also what Jim has been doing is exactly what we do, and what, you know, folks that are trying to learn bird calls and stuff do, is associating the sound with something else. It helps make an association in your mind. So, for example, to the training, I take fine-tooth combs with me and have the group run their fingers across it and listen to that sound, and then play the chorus frog, and that kind of cements it, I think, in people's heads. Northern leopard frogs or leopard frogs are described as, like, if you run your finger across a balloon, and we'll demonstrate that. And I also think northern leopard frogs sound a little bit like a creaky door in a haunted house kind of thing. Anyway, just coming up with any association.
Yeah, let's listen to the northern leopard frogs.
Singing, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Oh, that's a good one, Jim. Yeah.
Look at me.
It's hard to think. It's hard to think about those northern leopard frogs getting noticed above the chorus frog and the spring peeper. They're much more subtle.
Yeah, and that's one thing, you know, that's a tip I would have for folks, is that, you know, chorus frogs can be heard a half a mile away on a nice still night. They are incredibly loud for such a tiny little frog, as Jim was saying. But northern leopard frogs are much bigger, but they're also just really soft and harder to hear. So for sure, the closer you can get to a body of water, the more species you might be able to hear. And it also, if you do walk up to a body of water and scare all the frogs so that they're silent, you know, listening during that initial ramp up, can sometimes, you can hear some of those quieter species.
Oh, interesting. And what's the range of the northern leopard frog, Stephanie?
The northern leopard frog is statewide. We actually have three species of leopard frog in the state, and it's the most widespread. So it's statewide. We also have plains leopard frogs that are kind of the southern half of the state, and then southern leopard frogs, which are in the very far southeastern corner.
We are talking about frogs and toads of Iowa today. With me, Stephanie Shepherd, wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and wildlife biologist Jim Pease. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, your observations. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. And a reminder that, of course, we welcome learners of all ages to these shows. And we have a web post at iowapublicradio.org where we've shared some links to information. HerpNet is a great resource in Iowa where you can learn all kinds of things about the amphibians of Iowa. And also, we've got some vocabulary words and discussion questions, so you can talk about this with your family. I do want to get to the phones. Mike is on the line in Nevada. Hi, Mike. Mike, are you there? Okay. Maybe we'll get back to Mike in just a moment. We'll have our producer check in with him. He had his radio up, so I was hearing myself back, but I wasn't hearing Mike. So we'll get back to him in just a moment. We do have an email asking about the tree frogs that love to hang out on my patio. This is from Thomas in Polk City. Tell me about these tree frogs that love to hang out on my patio door eating bugs next to the light in the summer. Jim?
Oh, yeah, this is wonderful because tree frogs are somewhat different in that they all have these suction cups on each of the toes of their, particularly their front feet, but usually on their back feet as well. And so they can literally climb glass. And if you have a big patio door and you have great tree frogs around, they will hang out below the light that you might have out your patio, because the light attracts insects at night, and the frogs have figured this out. They're pretty smart little guys, and they just hang there waiting for the insects to show up in front of them. It's a free meal time, you know. It's a time to get your lunch in a bucket right there for you. I've also seen American toads hang out below light. They can't climb the glass like great tree frogs can, but they will sit on the patio below the light as bugs drop down, and they'll grab the bugs below them too. So they're opportunistic predators, just like a lot of predators are. The great tree frog is that's the usual color, but they have this wonderful ability to modify the color of their skin to better match the background. So if they're on tree bark, that gray works pretty well. If they're on a green leaf, however, their body actually migrates to sort of a green color so that they blend in better. So they're a really wonderful example of the abilities of anurids, of frogs and toads to adapt to their surroundings. And of course, then we have lots of frogs and toads all over the world, and some of the most famous ones are the ones in the tropics where you have the poison dart frogs and everything. But many of those are actually tree frogs as well. They have that suction cup on the toes. So a great tree frog is an Iowa tree frog. They're a little bigger than what we've been talking about. They're more the size, maybe inch and a half long, if you just look at their body. If you stretch their legs out, they can be more like 3 or so inches long. So they're really adaptable, beautiful little frog.
All right, well, let's listen to the gray tree frog. One of my favorite things about the gray tree frog is just that it can surprise you. in so many places. Yeah. There's one that shows up on my daughter's bedroom window pretty much every year. And the first time that happened, she was probably 5 years old and very, very surprised by that. Some good memories there. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We, of course, would love to hear from you with your questions, your observations. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We're talking about frogs and toads today. We've got wildlife biologist Jim Pease and Stephanie Shepherd of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources with us. 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about frogs and toads. We've got wildlife biologist Jim Pease here with us. While schools are closed, Jim is our resident biology teacher here on Talk of Iowa. And we've also got some support materials on our website, iowapublicradio.org, where you can find some vocabulary words and some discussion questions as well. Jim Pease is Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. Stephanie Shepherd is here, wildlife biologist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. She also runs the Frog and Toad Survey. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. And we have a lot of questions and comments to get to. So let's get to the phone. Mike is with us this time in Nevada. Hello, Mike.
Hello there. I'm actually on the road, Charity, but my hat tips to Stephanie for hopping to it this time of year. And hello, Jim.
And so, Mike, you're a volunteer. You help count frogs and toads?
Yes, I do. I've got two different routes that I run.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been doing it for probably about 15 years.
What have you observed over that time?
Well, one thing that I have observed is on one of the routes in particular, the habitat has gone through some changes. Some of the areas that were once really nice wetlands or CRP grounds have been drained, tiled, and converted. So I'm lucky if I hear the toad now in that area in certain times of the year.
Stephanie, you want to comment?
I would say habitat is a critical thing for these little guys.
Yeah, for sure. Stephanie, do you want to comment on that too?
Yeah, one of the main things that we try to get at with the Frog and Toad Survey or one of the pieces of information is documenting that change in the landscape and how the frogs and toads respond to it. It can be kind of depressing as a volunteer to have to go out and, you know, survey sites that aren't any longer being used or where the numbers have gone down quite a bit. But that gives us really valuable information about how these species respond to changes in the landscape and habitat.
All right. And we have
Mike.
Yeah, Mike, yeah. Thank you so much for doing that work and for helping survey frogs and toads. We have some more questions. This is from a group with 2 fourth graders and a second grader listening together today. So from Harris, Atticus, and Waits in Iowa City. The first question, Stephanie, I'll ask you, how many types of frogs and toads live in Iowa?
There are about 16. There's one species, the wood frog, that has never been identified here, but it occurs like right on the Iowa border in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So we kind of suspect it's here, but it's just never been picked up here. So those that have been documented, there's 16.
All right, 16 different species. And how many would you say are common species?
Oh, gosh. Maybe 10 to 12 of those.
All right.
Yeah. Depends where you are in the state, too. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Now, the second question, Jim, this is a hard one. So I don't know if you know the answer or not. What is the most endangered frog in the world?
In the world?
Yeah.
Probably, well, I can think of one in this hemisphere that's very endangered is the golden toad, which used to be very, very common in the tropics, in the mountains, actually, of Costa Rica, where I actually used to hear them when I first started going there. And now they haven't been heard in several years in the areas where they were once common. And that's not necessarily, part of it is habitat change, but it's also the impact of climate change as the country has warmed. Things have, you know, the rains are less predictable, all sorts of things happen. And so that's why these understanding these critters are so important for us, because if we can do what Stephanie is doing with tracking, and all the volunteers around the state with tracking the abundance, the relative abundance of these species and the individual species themselves, you have some index as to what is happening in the environment around you. And they serve as sort of, if you will, the canary in the coal mine.
Well, you may have to explain what you mean by canary in the coal mine, Jim.
Well, the coal miners used to take canaries in cages down into the coal mines with them. And if the canaries were very sensitive to the oxygen levels in the air. And so if the canary would keel over, they would say, it's time to get out. And so it was a warning signal. And I think of amphibians very much that way, too, because these guys absorb very important to absorb not only oxygen, but they absorb the chemicals and everything else in the world around them. That skin being wet and being such low to the ground critters, most of them, they serve as a warning sign that something, if they're disappearing, something's not right with our world, and we need to change the way we manage that.
And I've done quite a bit of reading over the past decade, that there are a lot of frog populations and toad populations that are disappearing and endangered, and we're even seeing physical changes because of pollution. Stephanie, just briefly, can you shed a little bit of light on that? Because we'll, in polluted areas, we'll find frogs that have mutations.
Right. Sometimes it's not just, it's not direct mortality, but it definitely affects the development of the frog. Frogs go through metamorphosis, as many people know. They start as an egg and then fully aquatic tadpole before then growing legs and coming up on land. And so there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of changes that happen. And some of this pollution can get in the way of those changes and cause mutations, as you said, extra legs, missing legs, missing eyes, things like that. And it's not just necessarily chemicals and stuff like that, but also things like UVB radiation, which has increased over time because of loss of ozone in the atmosphere, that also can impact eggs, you know, early in development, because eggs can't move out of the way or move into the shade, and they get exposed to that pretty harshly.
Now, the boys that were listening in Iowa City, maybe that was more than they wanted to know about endangered frogs, but that's all right. They have one more question, and this is my favorite question. Jim, what's the best time of day and temperature to go searching for them?
The best time of day is actually at night. So you can have your dinner and just after dark, just after dinner, I should say, 6:30, 7:30, sometimes 8 o'clock, sometimes a little later as the days get longer as we go into the spring, listen outside. And so as the sun's going down, as it gets to be dusk, that's when the frogs begin to come out. But the darker it is, the stronger they're, as long as it doesn't get too cold, the stronger their songs will be. Stephanie, what do you recommend for people between 8 and 10 o'clock at night?
Yeah, the survey is meant to start a half hour post-sunset, just simply because that's when you've got the most species of frogs and individuals calling. So if you're interested in calling, that's definitely the best time to go out.
Now, Jim, you have a way. So right now it's too cold to go out and hear them and to see them. But you have a way to create a frog chorus at home or around the campfire. We can have a virtual campfire here. And I know that you need 4 different singers for this. So, Stephanie,
right,
you're game to participate in this, right?
Sure.
All right. And we're going to bring Dennis Reese, our fourth voice, in here as well. Dennis Reese, you're with us?
I'll try.
Okay. So, Jim, here we are around our virtual campfire or around our kitchen table. Can you teach us how to create a chorus of frogs?
You bet. I've done this with hundreds and hundreds of kids over the years, so it's great, and adults. So it's great fun. Good family activity. So, Dennis, you're going to be the bullfrog. And the way bullfrogs sound is sort of like saying very low and slow the word potatoes. So you go, potatoes, potatoes. Potatoes, potato. Can you do that?
Potatoes, potatoes, potatoes.
Oh, good,
good,
good.
Well done.
Very bullfrog-like.
About
yeah, okay. Really good.
Hash browns.
No, no, don't. You can't riff on this, Dennis. You have to follow directions.
Hash browns are a different species. Okay, all right. So then, Stephanie, you're going to be the leopard frog, and they're the ones that say fried bacon. Fried bacon. Fried bacon. Can you do that?
Fried bacon. Fried bacon.
Very well done.
Great.
That was good.
And Charity, you're going to be the spring peepers. And spring peepers, these don't all call at the same time necessarily, but they do in this chorus.
Okay. All right.
The spring peepers, you say the word tomatoes as high and as fast as you can. It's sort of tomatoes, 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 tomatoes.
Okay.
Do that?
Yes. Tomatoes, 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 tomatoes.
Okay. And I'm going to be the green frog. The green frog, all these other frogs seem to have a really great sense of rhythm. But the green frog is a little more random. He sounds like a broken banjo string. He just kind of randomly blurts it out. And no sense of rhythm at all. So I'm going to be going, squash, squash. All right. So we're going to bring in first the bullfrog, then the leopard frog, Stephanie, and then the spring peepers, Charity, and then the green frog last will come in. So let's start with the bullfrog. You keep going each time, okay? Keep going, Dennis.
Potatoes, 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 potatoes.
Okay.
Potatoes,
leopard frog.
Potatoes.
Fried bacon.
Potatoes.
Fried bacon.
Potatoes.
Fried bacon.
Potatoes.
Fried bacon.
Potatoes.
Tomatoes. 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 Tomatoes.
Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Tomatoes.
Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Tomatoes. Thank you, Dennis and Stephanie, for playing along with that. It sounds a little more beautiful outside when I hear that, but definitely a great way to recreate that at home. Let's go back to the phones. We still have a lot of people with questions. Mary is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
That was great, first of all.
Thanks.
And also, I just want to thank Jim Pease. Due to his visit 20 years ago, we put in two wetlands. And my question is, one of the wetlands, yeah, you might remember it coming to the Carters, but one of the wetlands, we have a cacophony of frogs all season, you know, their season. But then the other wetland, they might be a few, and then they die or... We don't hear anything on that. Now, the one that we have a lot of going on, the water coming in comes from a hay field to the north. The other one comes from a conventional corn and soybeans field. Does that affect the frogs, and is there anything we can do to enrich the habitat on that other wetland?
Yeah, it certainly would. The runoff is very different from those two different habitats. We know that from lots of research. That the runoff off of a row crop field will be different than the runoff off of hay or grassland. The hay or grassland is able to, any chemicals that are used, and there are fewer chemicals used usually on hay field, alfalfa fields, and so that is able to percolate through the soil, and the runoff doesn't have the chemicals in it. And I suspect that's, whereas on the row crop land, there's nothing there necessarily to slow down or stop. The plants can only use so much of that, and excess chemical runs off, whether it be herbicides or other pesticides or even the fertilizer. So yeah, the quality of the water, you've put your finger right on it. The difference is the watershed that water's coming off of, and it impacts certainly the amphibian populations in those two different wetlands. That's a great observation. So,
all right. Well, Mary, thank you so much for that call. Here's a question from Lachlan in Iowa City. He said, I found a frog last week that had a baby frog on its back. Can you tell me about this behavior? What did he see? Jim?
Well, I doubt that it was a baby frog. No baby frogs yet. But it may have been a male. It may have been a male. Males are sometimes smaller than females, depends on the species. And males mount the females on the back to breed. And he may have been finding a male with a male on her back.
All right. So don't get too embarrassed, but the successful conclusion of the singing.
That's right. That's right. Hey, it works.
That's right. Well, and we only have a couple of minutes left. So let's do some basic biology here. We talked about the male frogs and toads are singing for their mates. They mate. The females then lay eggs. And I think most of us have seen a lot of tadpoles in ponds. And there are so many of them. So the frogs are kind of playing the numbers game like rabbits do. They produce a lot of young, right, Jim? So tell me a little bit about the process.
Absolutely. They produce hundreds of young, depending on the species, of course. And those eggs will then, depending on the temperature of the water, they develop, hatch into tadpoles. Those tadpoles are able to absorb this dissolved oxygen that's in the water. They're able to absorb the oxygen out of the water. They eat algae and zooplankton and phytoplankton in the water. Gradually begin to, as they start to sprout legs, gulp air. So they're developing their lungs. So they have gills to begin with. And then they develop lungs over time as they develop into adult frogs. And they start gulping air. You'll see tadpoles doing that during the summer. They're gulping air at the surface. They're beginning to develop those lungs. And then as they get their lungs fully developed, they crawl out on land as adults as their tail shrinks as well. So it's a fun process to watch. You can listen to them now and watch them through the summer as they develop in that pond, that little wetland, even that shallow pool that only lasts for a few weeks in the spring, in the middle of your woodland. It's a great time to be out there and seeing what's going on in the world. So.
All right. Well, Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Stephanie Shepherd, thank you.
Thanks so much for including me.
Jim Pease, wildlife biologist and our resident biology teacher, and Stephanie Shepherd, it works for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We'll be back again with more wildlife information next Tuesday. This is Talk of Iowa.